All right, so it looks like now that you know the routine, four sign-in sheets is plenty to avoid bottlenecks. Everyone cool with that? I want to remind everyone that what I've already told you or what you should already know if you are doing your duty and looking at the announcements, and that's that since this is the first regular Thursday, I'm not going to be able to hang around at all on Thursday. Remember, I got to leave immediately for the first lab. So if you do need to see me today, you're going to have to come into one of those labs. All right, we were on slide 17, as according to my memory, and we've already talked about this, but just to make a nice smooth segue into today's stuff, let's quickly remember what we were saying. That's too dark, isn't it? How did I have this? Is that too light? All right. Anyway, we were looking at phagocytosis, and that is what category of cellular transport? Vesicular transport, exactly. And what subcategory of vesicular transport is it? It is endocytosis. It's specifically endocytosis of a solid particle rather than a liquid slug. In 18, we're looking at another example of vesicular transport, and it's another example of endocytosis. This is specifically called receptor-mediated endocytosis because it is mediated by receptors. Receptors are necessary for this to occur. The receptors shown in purple here are what kind of macromolecules? What is it? No guesses as to what the receptors are? They are not hormones. Hormones bind to receptors. Also, though, hormones isn't one of the four macromolecule types. Yes, they're proteins. Receptors in general are proteins because proteins can have just about any shape you want. They are perfect for the job of serving as a receptor because a receptor has to have the right shape to receive something. In this case, what they're receiving are these extracellular molecules, which could be just about anything. Unless those are present, the endocytosis doesn't occur. The invagination of the plasma membrane won't occur until these molecules of the right type come along, and thereby, this is how the cell knows they're there, basically. When they bind to the specific receptors that are bound to the plasma membrane, that binding event, remember, causes shape change in the protein itself, in this case the receptors, which causes the invagination to occur that gives rise to the endocytosis. So it's an invagination or an in-pocketing first, but as that proceeds, then it seals off at the other end, and now you have a full-blown vesicle that is inside the cell. And like I was saying last time, the stuff that's inside that vesicle is now inside the cell, but that stuff never went through a membrane. That's the hallmark of vesicular transport, as opposed to passive and active transport, in which case something actually does go through the membrane. In 19, another example of vesicular transport, but in this case, it's in the other direction. So this is exocytosis we're looking at, which is how a lot of cells in glandular tissue secrete their secretory product, whatever that is. So we have a secretory vesicle, which is simply a little bag made of membrane containing whatever that stuff is that gets secreted by that type of cell. That's all the gray stuff inside the vesicle. And that's made beforehand, inside the cell, of course. And the vesicle is ready to go. Sometimes it can just be there for a while. Other times it's going to immediately be exocytosed. But it's not going to exocytose, in any case, until that vesicle fuses to the inner surface of the plasma membrane. And remember, all this membrane material is basically the same. It's all made out of phospholipid bilayer with other stuff in there as well. The phospholipid bilayer substructure allows any sort of membrane to fuse into any other sort of membrane. So when the vesicle is at the ready, but not quite yet fused, it's a simple matter of causing that fusion to occur, which can occur as a response to signals or other mechanisms. But you can see the fusion has occurred, and that basically just reverses the process of endocytosis. And it will spill the contents outward. Now that contents is out of the cell where it was inside the cell, but yet again, it has never passed through a membrane, actually. All you did was open up the vesicle. Well, I included slide 20, which is a table, a summary table, simply because these can sometimes be useful things to study. We've covered, I've talked about most of this already, but I'm not going to sit here and read a table to you. In general, I don't read tables to you, but you might want to use that in studying. By the way, your test is in a little less than a week, right? So you do realize that. Okay. I say less than a week because we're already past 10:30. It's 1 week from today if you want to round it to a whole day. Okay, 21. This is another one of these catch-all pictures that includes a lot of things in a kind of a prototypical cell. Did I talk about microvilli already? Yeah, I thought I did. When I talked about the endothelium of the intestine, right? Yeah, okay. So we have microvilli on this one as well. We've already talked about that, though. The major thing in this slide that we haven't talked about is the cytoskeleton. I've mentioned the word cytoskeleton, but here we see a little bit better detail of what the cytoskeleton consists of. And it really is just a network of proteins of various types. There are three major kinds or categories of proteins. There are multiple examples of each of those categories, but the cytoskeleton consists of three major types of fibrous proteins. Before I give you those, let me just say that any given protein, whether it's part of the cytoskeleton or not, just proteins in general can be, they fall into a dichotomy or a two-part way of classifying them. They're either globular or they are fibrous. Fibrous proteins are long and slender because they act as fibers for various reasons. Other proteins fold into a more or less compact shape, and they are a glob, so they are globular. Enzymes, for instance, are globular proteins. But proteins that are mostly used for structural functions are fibrous proteins. Act as little ropes or cables, for instance. And that's true for the cytoskeletal elements. So these three cytoskeletal elements, which are categories of proteins themselves, are microtubules, microfilaments, and intermediate filaments. Now, intermediate filaments are the most variable of the three, meaning that there's quite a few different kinds of intermediate filaments. And they get their name simply because, in terms of the diameter of that fibrous protein, intermediate filaments are somewhere between the diameter of the biggest ones, which are the microtubules, and the smallest ones, which are the microfilaments. So microfilaments shown here are the most wispy of all of them. I don't even know whether you can see them very well on this picture. They're kind of the dark orange ones that... are they labeled anywhere? Oh, yeah. Well, that's a microtubule. I'm talking about a microfilament. Oh, yeah, top right. The microfilaments in this case, a good example of them, this is not the only place they're found, but microfilaments do fill the interior of microvilli, which this cell happens to have. Not all cells have microvilli. But when there's a microvillus, it's full of microfilaments. Microfilaments are also used in your skeletal muscles. This is how your skeletal muscles are able to shorten, and we'll talk much more about that. That'll probably be the most challenging part of the course for most people. So you can look forward to that in test 3. Microtubules, the biggest ones, and the ones that are the dark orange here, those are called microtubules, first of all, because they have a hollow center. But these are important for a couple major reasons. They are involved in cell division, mitosis and meiosis, uses these microtubules, which form, many microtubules form what is called the mitotic spindle, and that allows for the separation of chromosomes during that cell division process. But also, before the cell decides it's time to divide, during its own lifetime, in other words, the microtubules serve as little roadways. There are things called motor proteins that are still other proteins that will carry, like a vesicle, which itself is carrying some cargo, and the motor proteins will literally, one step at a time, walk along these microtubules from one place in the cell to another. So you shouldn't think of a cell as just being a loose bag of randomness. The cell is a dynamic, always changing, but highly ordered structure, mainly because of this cytoskeleton. The intermediate filaments are there mostly for structural integrity. They act as little cables holding things together and whatnot. Microfilaments are often used for motility, some sort of movement, and microtubules for what I just talked about. Those are the three components, though, of the cytoskeleton. Now, we note also we have desmosomes and hemidesmosomes, a desmosome on the left and a hemidesmosome on the right. This is an example of an intercellular junction. It's called an intercellular junction because it's a place where two cells come together, well, at least in the case of desmosomes. Desmosomes are like little spot welds that hold two adjacent cells against each other. A hemidesmosome, which literally means half of a desmosome, is so called because it's not holding two cells together, it's holding one cell in an epithelium onto the basal lamina, or the layer that epithelial cell layer is built upon. They're in this picture as well, though. And now we can look at some pictures of things I've already mentioned, but we can look at it in greater detail because they're magnified in these images. In slide 22, we're looking at just a close-up of the nucleus. So that's not a cell we're looking at on the left. That whole circle is just the nucleus of a cell. The cell would be bigger than the screen. So obviously this is a eukaryotic cell we're looking at. Otherwise it wouldn't have a nucleus. Inside a nucleus, we have a region that you have to be careful with on that word. It's called nucleolus. Nucleolus and nucleus are separate words. The nucleolus is part of the nucleus. And the nucleolus is a region, remember, in the nucleus overall, of course, there's DNA, right? That's where the DNA is housed. And so DNA carries genes. The genes are responsible for being transcribed. But most of your genes are so-called protein coding genes, which means when they are transcribed, they make messenger RNA, which then leaves the nucleus, finds ribosomes, and undergoes the process of translation, which is actually assembly of a protein. But you have some genes that are non-protein coding genes. Those are just responsible for making other kinds of RNA besides messenger RNA. And that stuff is happening in the nucleolus, specifically genes for ribosomal RNA. Ribosomal RNA, or rRNA, is stuff the cell makes by reading specific genes of DNA in that nucleolus. These ribosomal RNA molecules then are packaged into ribosomes, which are the things that get the things that give the rough endoplasmic reticulum their name, what I talked about earlier, the tiny little molecular machines whose job it is to actually assemble proteins one amino acid at a time based on the information that is in messenger RNA. This is partly beyond the scope of this course, but that's what the nucleolus is all about. It's mainly transcription of non-protein coding genes, ribosomal RNA. The The nucleus itself is not only a membrane-bounded organelle, it's a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. There are actually two phospholipid bilayers, two layers of membrane that collectively are called the nuclear envelope. That's what really defines the nucleus. And so you have an inner membrane of the nuclear envelope that is then surrounded by an outer one, of course, and the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope actually pinches off here and there and is continuous with or gives rise to the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So the rough endoplasmic reticulum is actually, it transitions directly into the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope. And one thing that we haven't mentioned about the nuclear envelope or the nucleus in general is that the envelope is perforated. It's full of holes, basically, called nuclear pores. Nuclear pores are actually complexes of proteins that are bound to that membrane, forming little tunnels in them, kind of like channels, but even much, much bigger opening than a normal ion channel like we've talked about before. And this is important because in a eukaryotic cell, there is compartmentalization. You have the stuff that's inside the nucleus, which is collectively called the nucleoplasm, and then the stuff that's outside of the nucleus but still inside the cell, which collectively is called the cytoplasm, two different compartments in which different things happen. So DNA is being transcribed in the nucleus. That produces messenger RNA, for instance, for most of the genes. That messenger RNA then needs to get out of the nucleus and go to a ribosome, which is out in the cytoplasm, in order to be translated. Transcription comes first. That creates the messenger RNA. The messenger RNA is holding the code for how to build a protein, but to build that protein, it needs to meet up with a ribosome, which is out in the cytoplasm. So the messenger RNA, after it's created inside the nucleus, needs to get out of that nucleus, and that's one of the reasons why you have nuclear pores in the nuclear envelope. There's also, though, proteins that are built outside in the cytoplasm that need to do their jobs inside the nucleus. So those need to be imported into the nucleus from the cytoplasm, and they get strung through these nuclear pores as well, just in the reverse direction. Slide 23 gives you a cartoon view of the overall endoplasmic reticulum. Reticulum, by the way, is a word that really just means small network. Reti, R-E-T-E, is a word that means network. And the iculum suffix is diminutive, meaning that it means a small whatever the first part of the word is. So reticulum literally means a small network. And that gets its name because of its membrane is arranged in like a mesh-like arrangement. And keep in mind, oh, I think I mentioned this before, that the overall endoplasmic reticulum really has two subdivisions. Even though it's all one organelle, and it's all connected, it's divided into what we call the rough ER, rough endoplasmic reticulum, and the smooth ER. And the roughness comes from the fact that that part of this organelle is studded on its surface with ribosomes, the little dots in this picture. So this left part of the blue is the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And why is it studded with ribosomes? What is the major job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum? Everyone hear all those answers? I didn't hear any of them. I just heard a murmur. Protein synthesis. Yeah, not all protein synthesis. There's plenty of proteins that are synthesized out in the cytoplasm, but certain proteins need to be modified after they're produced. And those are the ones that get... the ribosome gets sent over to the endoplasmic reticulum so that the protein, as it's made, gets strung into the lumen, or the hollow interior of the endoplasmic reticulum. Lumen is a general word. It means the hollow part of a hollow structure. Blood flows, for instance, through the lumen of a blood vessel, L-U-M-E-N. So anyway, the endoplasmic reticulum receives these brand new proteins and then modifies them in some way, packages them in a vesicle, and sends them to the Golgi. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum, on the other hand, is smooth because it doesn't have these ribosomes, and that's because it's not concerned with protein synthesis. It does various things, including lipid synthesis. but also storage of various things. Importantly, and what we're going to talk about mostly in this course, in skeletal muscle, it stores, the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, that is, stores calcium ions so that they can be released only when appropriate from that smooth endoplasmic reticulum into the cytosol. This is a signal that allows your skeletal muscles to contract. So when their muscles are relaxed, the smooth endoplasmic reticulum stockpiles those calcium ions so that they're not released as signals, but then they get released every time you contract a muscle. All right, that's endoplasmic reticulum. Let's go to 24. This is the Golgi, which some books just call it the Golgi, or the Golgi complex, or the Golgi apparatus, interchangeable words or phrases. Golgi is an eponym, by the way, which is a word that's named after someone, which biology, unfortunately, is full of. Decreasingly so, biology is trying to get away from the use of eponyms because they're not, they don't tell you anything, right? They're just named after some dead white man who discovered them. But there's some of them have just been used so long that everyone wants to keep calling them that, including Golgi. The Golgi complex, though, it looks kind of similar to the endoplasmic reticulum, except it's more like flattened sacks. It looks kind of like a stack of pancakes. And it lies in the cell right beside the endoplasmic reticulum, which makes sense because the Golgi complex receives vesicles that pinch off from the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So the rough endoplasmic reticulum, remember, modifies proteins that are made inside its lumen and then packages them in vesicles which pinch off of the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum and travel the short distance to the Golgi complex where they fuse with the Golgi complex, and therefore the contents of those vesicles get spilled into the lumen of the Golgi. And the Golgi figures out what kind of proteins they are and maybe modifies them further, and in any case sends them to their proper destination, which could be to another membrane-bounded organelle within the cell, or it could be completely out of the cell by exocytosis, or it could be movement of proteins to the actual plasma membrane as membrane-bound proteins. And that happens, by the way, you know, if something is contained fully inside of a vesicle and that vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, it's going to be exocytosed. It's going to be moved totally out of the cell. But if proteins are actually part of the vesicle, if they get actually stuck to the membrane of the vesicle itself, then when the same thing happens and it fuses to the plasma membrane, now that membrane that used to be the vesicle is part of the plasma membrane, and those proteins that are in that membrane are now part of the plasma membrane. This is how the cell embeds membrane-bound proteins into the plasma membrane, and it can take them up by the opposite action, by endocytosis. I don't think I mentioned, slide 25, peroxisomes or lysosomes, but they are also organelles. And they're also membrane-bounded organelles, so they have their own little membrane. To look at them, you would think they're just vesicles because they're little bags of membrane, but they get special names because they do special functions. Lysosomes are called that because they specialize in lysis, which is the degradation or the splitting or the digestion of something. So lysosome will be a little vesicle basically with hydrolytic enzymes, enzymes that specialize in splitting things apart, breaking big things down into smaller things. For instance, a food particle, for instance, that could be coming in via endocytosis, phagocytosis, that we just looked at. Now you have two vesicles, one that was already in the cell, a lysosome, and one that's coming in that's called now a phagosome because it's something that the cell made by eating something. When those two fuse together, now you have a slightly bigger lysosome where the particle that was ingested is now exposed to those enzymes that will digest it. And that's something that you want to house away from the rest of the cytoplasm because Digestive enzymes are dangerous things to have around. You only want to digest the things you want to break apart, not the cell's integrity itself. So that's why they're locked away in their own little chamber. Peroxisomes similarly lock something away from the rest of the cytoplasm safely. As the name implies, peroxisomes deal with handling the problem of peroxides and other reactive oxygen species, as they're generically called, or ROS, reactive oxygen species, are created here and there as normal, as part of normal metabolism, and also because of mistakes here and there in biochemistry. But they are highly reactive, as the name implies, which means if you let these things near DNA or other parts of the cell, they will start reacting with them and damage them. This is oxidative damage. This is why antioxidants are a big thing today for health reasons. Antioxidants try to minimize those damaging effects of reactive oxygen species, which themselves are oxidants. So peroxisomes do this by having special enzymes in themselves, which once they import the ROS, will deal with them safely and produce basically water or something other harmless, something else that's harmless. 26, you should recognize, this is a mitochondrion. It's the second of three examples of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. Actually, only two that are in your own cells. The nucleus is multiply membrane-bounded, like I said. So is the mitochondrion. So are chloroplasts, but we as animals don't have chloroplasts. Those are found only in photosynthetic eukaryotes, like plants. But anyway, the mitochondrion is also doubly membrane-bounded. So there's an outer and an inner membrane, which are called that, the outer mitochondrial membrane and the inner mitochondrial membrane. And notice that the outer membrane is actually smaller than the inner membrane. And that's because the outer membrane is really just a smooth covering, as big as it needs to be, whereas the inner membrane is highly elaborated. It's folded a lot here and there. Those folds themselves are called cristae, which, if you add an E to crista, you make the plural of it. Why would you have these cristae? Why would you have all these folds in the inner membrane? Exactly. Just like you have folds making up microvilli to increase surface area, the cristae of a mitochondrion drastically increases the surface area, which is important because the major job of the mitochondrion, it has multiple functions, but the major job is cellular respiration, a complex set of biochemical reactions that oxidize the fuels that you eat, extract energy from them, and produce ATP molecules to store that energy as much as possible. Well, that happens because of membrane-bound proteins. Therefore, the more membrane you have, the more proteins you can bind to that membrane, and therefore the more efficiently you can undergo those biochemical reactions that make up cellular respiration. That's why you have such an elaborate folding. By the way, well, I'm not even going to get into that. Well, before I leave, though, this is something else. Let me just say that since the mitochondrion is doubly membrane-bounded, that means the mitochondrion itself has two compartments. There's a compartment that occurs between the two membranes, and that very descriptively is called the intermembrane space. But then there's the compartment that's fully inside the inner membrane, and that's called the mitochondrial matrix, which is both of those actually are labeled there. 27. What you're looking at in orange individually are microtubules, just like I described before. But one use of microtubules is to produce these structures, which look like little chunks of licorice, basically. And these are called centrioles. You have a pair of centrioles in each of your cells, or at least you do at one point in the cell cycle of your cell. The centrioles are components of the centrosome, which I've already mentioned, but not today. Remember that the centrosome is a microtubule organizing center. It's also an important player in cell division, mitosis and meiosis. And so the centrosomes are these regions that become the centers of separate cells once the one cell splits into two. But within those centrosomes are two centrioles situated at right angles to each other. And they're made of microtubules, but we don't still know really what the hell they do. Because plant cells, for instance, don't have centrioles. They have centrosomes, but their centrosomes don't have any centrioles. And plant cells undergo mitosis just fine without any centrioles. And in fact, you can experimentally remove the centrioles from animal cells and still have them undergo mitosis. So it's very likely that they're not just there for nothing. Otherwise, evolution would have phased them out long ago. But just an example of the fact that we don't know everything. It's a good way to be able to tell, though, that you're looking at an animal cell rather than a plant cell. If there's centrioles there, then it's animal. 28. Oh, another table. And I just told you I'm not going to read these to you. Yeah, that's just a summary of the major organelles. So, thing to study, but... Oh, that's the end of the chapter. Any questions before I transition to the next chapter?